Find all sorts of opinions and add your own at RN Online.
Hello, this is Big Ideas on RN. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for your company tonight. Is human behaviour shaped by evolution in the same way, say, that evolution has determined that we walk upright, have a thumb, or have developed a large brain? It's a far-reaching question, and if you agree with this position, with what's called evolutionary psychology, then what does this mean for ethics, morality, and responsibility? John August is the Vice President of the Humanist Society of New South Wales. Tonight, he looks at how evolution operates and concludes from that how evolution affects our behaviour. It's a highly disputed topic. The linguistics and definitions are not clear-cut. There are controversies over nature versus nurture and also over how much we can learn from animals, even more so over the degree to which we can compare animals and humans. Ethics is about what we ought to do and how we assess ethical actions. But evolutionary psychology, or EP, as John August calls it throughout his talk, is about what we do and why we do it, a different emphasis. EP speaks to the nature of altruism, cooperation, and selfishness. Here's John August explaining.
Now, I'll read out at least a past definition from Wikipedia. Evolutionary psychology attempts to explain mental and psychological traits such as memory, perception, or language as adaptations, that is, as the functional products of natural selection or sexual selection. Adaptation is thinking about physiological mechanisms such as the heart, lungs, and immune system is common in evolutionary biology. Evolutionary psychology applies the same thinking to psychology. Evolutionary psychologists argue that much of human behaviour is generated by psychological adaptations that evolve to solve recurrent problems in human ancestral environments. So that's the thing that I'm interested in. Now, my own qualification is in physics rather than psychology, so I'm talking about this to some degree as an outsider, but certainly as someone who has been long fascinated with evolution and its consequences, and this always seemed to be a very interesting aspect of evolution. Now, evolutionary psychology has come in for a lot of criticism. There's various things that people say about it. One is that it reduces our humanity, that it turns us into zombies or automatons or something mindlessly following our genetic programs, or that it might endorse brutal competition. And another thing is that it takes an apologist approach rather than being a neutral explanation of problematic behaviour like violence and rape. So working through some of these things, some people say that evolutionary psychology claims that our behaviour is just genetic heritage. I think that whenever you hear someone use the word just, it's normally a warning sign that someone's playing a Swifty there somewhere. Now, basically, one of the things about evolutionary psychology is it endorses different behaviour in different environments. It's not saying we do the same thing all the time and that we operate like a bunch of zombies always doing the same thing. We can actually do different things in different environments because our ancestors found that it was advantageous to do different things in different environments. In other words, you know, EP means that we want to have some flexibility in the way we relate to the world because flexibility is good. Now, it also allows for variation. Variation is the raw material of evolution. You know, things need to vary and that feeds into things. So that means that different people can behave differently. One of the things that people say is, but humans are so diverse, how can you possibly, you know, sort of try to all lump them into one? I mean, we could equally say there's something called human nature, which covers both the samurai warrior, the Buddhist nun, you know, criminals in New York and the working class in Britain, and yet, you know, there's this thing called human nature that covers us at all. Well, that's perhaps telling us that the notion of human nature is a bit problematic when you look at the details, but it's not a stupid thing to talk about either. And also, EP doesn't devalue creativity, and it's neutral about sovereignty. Now, okay, so we're saying people have certain drives, certain issues influencing them, and let's contrast that to sociology. Now, Sociology acknowledges human creativity and personal variability, but it nevertheless notes a degree of predictability, particularly given choices, and that you can take individual people operating and, you know, distill that into this is what society does. Now, if we walk between two locations, we will probably walk by the shortest route between those destinations. So there's an element of predictability in that context. So we can also consider the work of the economist in the US and I think his journalist associate who wrote the book Freakonomics. Now, they basically talk about three grand incentives that we have, the financial, legal and moral incentives. So the moral incentive, that's taking all of moral philosophy and reducing it to a single quantity called the moral incentive. We do the right things because we feel compelled to do right things. Now, on the one hand, that's abstracting away a lot of detail, and yet that form of analysis is very powerful. I can only invite you to read the books yourself or hear something about what they've done. But that analysis, for all that, doesn't deny creativity or individual sovereignty. So, like, we can't know exactly what an artist will produce. We can't know the nature of the painting that they put together and how it will appeal to the audience. But we can still have some idea of how much time that artist will spend making that creation, and we can also have some idea of how much it will sell for. So, you know, there are other layers of the analysis we can put on. So EP posits identifiable patterns and reproducibility in human behaviour without reducing everything to just the genes. Also, we can see choices evolution has taken with us and contrast that to the choices evolution made for other life forms. And basically, we can see patterns in that. And that's sexual dimorphism, sexual selection. We'll get to that where that covers that. Then we also have the idea that there's this thing called competition. And, you know, that starts to endorse greed is good, social Darwinism, and so on. Now, that's committing a naturalist fallacy. Basically, just because something is natural doesn't mean it's good. Diseases are bad. Hurricanes are bad. But we wouldn't say that they are good. So we can label something as something natural, something that has preceded us, and here's the processes by which it's come about. But that doesn't mean that we are endorsing it. So we can say there is this thing called competition. This is what it's come up with. That doesn't mean that we will also always endorse competition. And a hidden part of the story of evolution is that evolution does have a strong endorsement of cooperation, something that can actually get lost in the wash depending on who you are talking to. So we will actually get to that shortly. But the other dichotomy is between nature and nurture. And, you know, some people say, what's going on here? But if we think about nature and nurture, each extreme does actually deny sovereignty, does deny free will. We can say that there's something called genetic determinism. We have no free will. We're just following our genetic programming. But we can also go down the sociology path and say there's something called social determinism. We have no free will. We are slaves of our upbringing, our environment, advertising and various manipulations that are put upon us. So, you know, basically you can deny EP, go down the sociology path, and also end up denying humanity and freedom of choice. But the more complicated way of looking at things that people talk about these days, they say there is something called nature via nurture. There is both genetic and social parts. You know, basically, the environment triggers certain genetic programs. Now, one classic example of this is if you take a chimpanzee that is not afraid of snakes and show that chimpanzee a video of another chimpanzee that's afraid of snakes, that chimpanzee will then become afraid of snakes. But let's say you take a chimpanzee that's not afraid of flowers and show a videotape of another chimpanzee that is afraid of flowers or is at least portrayed to be afraid of flowers, that first chimpanzee will then just think that the other chimpanzee is a bit odd and won't actually become afraid of flowers. So what you have is a genetic ability to become afraid of snakes, but you're not born afraid of snakes. You're able to become afraid of snakes. You learn to become afraid of snakes based on your environment. So we have both nature and nurture operating together. And, you know, the way that this is normally called, it's called nature via nurture. So That's, to my way of thinking, a much better way of looking at things than if you say nature or nurture, it's getting a bit... I think that's being a bit superficial in the way you're asking your questions. Now, Professor Stephen Boyden of the ANU posits that we have an evolutionary drive towards obtaining the approval of others, but just what's involved in obtaining approval from others is socially determined. So there's an urge within us to say we want blah, but then you go out in the world and uncover the details of what that is. Okay, so social approval. We figure out what is normally done, and we try to do that, and we do that based on what we've observed. So there's basically an internal urge that's tuned by interacting with the environment. Now, you can also apply that to ideas about status and beauty, because beauty does vary in cultures, but on the one hand, it's also a universal. So we want status, we want status or beauty ourselves, or we want to pursue those who have beauty or status, and we find out exactly what status is or what beauty is in our culture by looking around us. Now, there's also delusions, and delusions can be linked to status. If you talk to someone who is basically has some mental health issues, they might tell you that they're very wealthy and they have their own personal aircraft or a personal helicopter or something like that. But go back 80 years and what they would have said was that they have a very expensive car. So your delusions are draw from the ideas of status that you've derived by looking at the world. So then... Okay, so we're jumping around a bit, but I suppose I need to do that. There's a lot of cover. It's not so easy. But the basics of evolution is that we have three things: inheritance, mutation, and natural selection. Now, selection acts to maximise reproductive success. Basically, we breed, we have children, we have progeny. Now, that means that we have adaptations that help us live, that help us reproduce. And those adaptations might have an identified functionality. In the case of lions, cheetahs, whatever, they can run fast to hunt down predators. Their muscles are adapted to have basically short bursts of intense speed. You know, that's the way things have been developed. Now, I did mention a competition versus cooperation. Now, that is one of the things about our social world. As individual animals, we need to eat. We need to drink, we need to run around. As humans, maybe we need shelter or whatever. And this is this interaction with the world around us. But when you live in a social environment, the interaction with others of your own species becomes, in a sense, as important as your relationships to the outside world. In our case, as human beings, we are very much a social thing. And a lot of our brains are actually being developed to deal with the social interactions we have in the world, rather than going out and doing our individual hunter-gatherer stuff or farming or whatever. A lot of stuff is about social interaction. Now, if you look at bats, now, some vampire bats, basically, they will go out and feed and then come back to the cave or the nest or whatever, and not all of them will have fed, and some of them will actually share their blood with the other bats who haven't fed. But in order to facilitate this, the bats have actually developed a rather specialised brain where they can actually recognise other individual bats. And because of that, they can figure out what bats have actually reciprocated and traded blood in the past, and we will sort of trade blood with them now. In other words, identifying others in the individuals can facilitate cooperation. And, you know, basically that's a lot of what is happening with us. But also there was the writer Kropotkin, who wrote Mutual Aid. Now, what he was emphasising was that in the face of this struggle against the world, it's very natural that animals will actually cooperate to help that along, because they're not just competing with each other. In a sense, they're competing with the world that's trying to draw them down. And so you can actually get a valid cooperation. Now, Kropotkin talks about that at various levels of detail. Now, one of the interesting things that Kropotkin talks about is cooperation between species. Now, there's several examples of that, but one interesting one he talks about is the marshalling area that birds all gather at before they migrate south. And, you know, you basically have birds of many different species gathering in these marshalling areas, all cooperating and then all leaving as a single flock composed of multiple different species to actually do that migration. Because they're all benefiting from each other, it makes sense to do it together, even though you're of different species. So you can actually get different species cooperating. Now, there's another thing that has developed ideas of cooperation, and that's called the price equation, which can actually does actually tease out some of the details of when animals might cooperate as compared to when they might defect or freeload. Now, the price equation was a development of ideas of group selection, and basically, you know, people were speculating on group selection, but it was much a mathematical development where they're actually able to identify groups in a, you know, mathematically rigorous fashion and understand how they changed. Now, the way to understand the price equation is to say, let's imagine we have different tribes. Now, one tribe is composed of perhaps 30 people. They get along well. Because they get along well and cooperate, that tribe will actually outperform other adjacent tribes. So it's basically performing well because of this shared cohesion that it has and its increased effectiveness because of that. But within the tribe, individuals can actually say, I will contribute to the tribe to make it work well, or I'll just freeload and do my own thing and just be carried along by this vigour that the tribe has. So there's a tension between the fact that a cohesive tribe will actually outperform other tribes and the fact that within that tribe, individuals may be tempted to defect and freeload. And obviously, when you have get the freeloaders beyond a critical point, the tribe loses cohesion and it can't actually cooperate in the way that it used to be able to do. And the price equation is a formula that lets us get at some of these details of cooperation and gives us a bit of an idea of when you'll actually get cooperation. So I've talked about some of the elements of evolutionary psychology. Now, one of its prescriptions is that our brain shows evidence of the environment that we've been evolved in, and we can sort of see that in particular things about how the brain operates. Now, I've spoken about our brain having specialised machinery to deal with social situations, and I'll illustrate that through a bit of an experiment that you can participate in, or a demonstration, I guess, that you can participate in. So basically, yes, we have a brain that's good at general problem solving. We can do a lot, but some things we have to work through very slowly, and then there's some things where you just go bang and you see what the result is. When you can just go bang and see the result, that is suggesting to us that there's some specialised hardware in our brain that's coming into play to help us with this particular problem. And so I'll try to illustrate that with this thing called Ebbinghaus disease. Now, that's a hypothesis about a medical condition. Say the hypothesis is that if a person has Ebbinghaus disease, that person will be forgetful. Now, what you want to know is the minimum number of propositions that disproves that assertion. Now, there are four propositions. Has Ebbinghaus disease, does not have Ebbinghaus disease, is forgetful, and is not forgetful. So what's the smallest number of propositions you need to disprove that? Now, the answer to that question, I guess we have to move along quickly if you struggle with it a bit, is has Ebbinghaus disease and is not forgetful. Now, when I first read this one, I was able to figure it out, but what you have to do is do this sort of mental game of mastermind in your head and sort of work through the permutations. You know, it doesn't come out at you, it doesn't jump out at you, you have to, as it were, work through it manually using what you might call our slow problem-solving machinery. But let's contrast this with a problem which has an identical logical structure but keys into real-life social concepts. The hypothesis is, if you borrow my car, you have to fill the tank with petrol. The four propositions are borrow car, not borrow car, fill up tank, not fill up tank. Now, the answer to that one is borrow car and not fill up tank. But if your brain is operating like mine, or hopefully like most people, you'll find that it just jumps into your head. Because what it's doing is recruiting the parts of our brain that deal in social interactions, reciprocation, favours, doing stuff and so on. So that's a very interesting one. I think that really does show that inside of our brain we do have a record of the fact that parts of our brain was exclusively evolved to deal with social situations. And you can see that in the difference in speed in solving different problems. But having said that, we have been evolved with a great deal of flexibility to solve a great deal of problems. Though one of the things, I don't have the philosophical details to hand, but one of the things is it's very hard for us to have any sort of absolutely general purpose problem-solving ability. It's going to have some constraints, it's going to have some limitations, and we might be able to discover those limitations by looking hard. But there's a philosophical point that we cannot be this totally open problem-solving system. It's got to have some constraints there. And there are some social science views that are problematic, which do imagine us to be a tabula rasa, I think it's called, and we just fill it up with experiences and cross-references and so on. And it's difficult to believe that is, in fact, the case. Now, so continuing down the sort of some of the story of evolutionary psychology, it's a good thing to understand the idea of side effects and adaptations. Now, side effects also have been known as what's called spandrels. Now, if you go into a cathedral or even a mosque, you'll find there's the pillars. The pillars go up to the ceiling, and before they reach the ceiling, they sort of splay out to spread out the load. And that means that on the side of the pillar, at the top of the pillars, you have this triangular surface, which is called a spandrel. And people have found that that spandrel is really nice for doing some artwork and making the cathedral or mosque look quite pretty. And now the thing is, you might think, aha, isn't it nice that they provided this place for us to do this nice artwork? But no, that spandrel was there, I guess, to distribute the load or provide a load path. And as an accident, it's a nice place to do some art. So it's a side effect. And that's one of the things about evolution, is that there's a lot of things we're able to do which were probably side effects of some other thing that was developed.
John August on Big Ideas on RN and online, talking about evolutionary psychology and how evolution is shaping our behaviour.
Now, there was Stephen Jay Gould. Now, Stephen Jay Gould, I think, was one of the biologists who was actually quite down on evolutionary psychology. But there is a cute example from his analysis. He talks about different evolutionary effects being the wedge and the wheel of fate. Now, the wedge is this classic one that we perhaps intuitively have some familiarity of evolution slowly grinding away and changing, shifting, changing its parameters. And that's in contrast to what's called the wheel of fate, where something is developed for some purpose and then it's found quite accidentally to be very useful for another purpose. And on the one hand, maybe that sort of side effect, or that would probably be a good way of describing that. Now, Stephen Jay Gould's classic example of this is we have plankton, okay? So plankton in the ocean, the Earth gets hit by a meteorite and the sky goes dark for 3 or 4 years and kills off most of the plankton. And then the dust sort of dissipates and the sun comes back in, but some of the plankton have survived. Now, what are the plankton that have survived? They're the plankton that hibernate for the winter, right? So basically they had the ability to hibernate for, 3 or 4 months or 6 months or whatever the local winter is. But being able to hibernate for 6 months means they're also able to hibernate for 4 years with no extra cost. It's sort of a bonus. So that means they can actually survive that asteroid strike, which wipes out all the other plankton. So they were evolved to basically hibernate, and they hibernated so that they could actually live in a part of the Earth's ocean that went cold regularly, but there was still some food worth taking advantage of during the summer months, so it's worth going into that niche and taking advantage of it. So you evolve something for that purpose, and then quite accidentally, that ability means that you can actually survive an asteroid strike winter. So, then there's other things that people talk about in evolution, that we can adjust violence, that we can basically change a lot of things. And I think there's some truth to the idea that you can change stuff, but I think a certain problem is that you might have this knob called violence that's connected to a lot of other knobs, and you can't individually adjust that knob. You change this and you change lots of other things. Now, for me, that's a minor issue. It's just an issue that I have, because I see people just free and easy saying, oh, we can adjust violence. And I'm thinking, well, I don't think violence is a unified thing. It's a bunch of behaviours that are realised in different ways, and we only imagine it to be a unified thing. And I do know there have been some writers in biology who have said that, the aggression, or the aggression of being a predator, is different to the aggression of being prey, but sort of striking back when you need to, when you're cornered, sort of thing. That in its one sense they're violence, but in one sense they're also different. And it's also worth keeping in mind that with evolution, you might get a species that makes a certain choice and then goes down a path, and it can't actually back up. It can only, as it were, explore the situation locally. So as long as things are working well enough, that species will continue to survive, but it has limited options for changing itself. So rather than saying evolution is about survival of the fittest, we can actually turn around and say evolution is about survival of the least inadequate. So, you know, basically what that's saying is that by some measures, this is a stupid, inefficient way of doing it, but basically it means that population can sustain itself in the environment, and also compared to its competitors, it can still make a go of things. Like there's some people who say that our spines are actually pretty grossly designed, and there's some animals, I forget the details, but you could basically drive over them with a car and it's not a problem. But our spines are somewhat more fragile because of just ad hoc design choices that evolution made along the way. And I also have to say, I'm saying design choices as though evolution is choosing. Philosophers would slap me on the wrist there. That is the wrong way of talking about evolution. Evolution is about randomness plus selection. That is something of a shorthand to describe what's going on. Otherwise, the wording does get rather messy. Okay, now we'll move on to sexual selection. Now, notice that the peacock has a very large tail, and basically, I think it's fair to say that if you're a peacock with that bigger tail, it's probably going to get in the way. It may well attract attention to the predators. It's going to be this bigger thing you've got to drag around that's basically making life difficult for you. And that's about sexual selection, because what you're competing for is not longevity. You're competing for reproduction. And sometimes reproduction is about attracting the attention of the opposite sex. So that means that rather than doing things that improve your efficiency, your longevity, broadly speaking, you're selected for the ability to mate with the opposite sex, attract attention to the opposite sex. So that's what we call sexual selection. The obvious example is with peacocks and peahens. And, you know, basically your mating process is more important than survival with respect to the outside world. Of course, that's a bit of an overstatement. Let's just say you have a trade-off between the quantities. Obviously, if your lifespan is so short, you don't survive for long enough to reproduce, it gets a bit silly. But you can understand it's basically going to push down your lifespan so that you may only have one chance of reproduction if you're lucky. Now, the other thing to also keep in mind is that normally females invest more in reproduction than males, and I guess that's certainly the case in people. So men pursue women, and broadly speaking, in the animal kingdom, males pursue females. That's to the extent we can take our own behaviour and project it onto animals. I mean, we can wave around microphones to each other and say, look, why did you do that? We can't do that with animals, but, you know, we have to make some jumps in logic to sort of do that. But anyway, getting past that, basically, for some birds, which are including emus, tinamous, shorebirds, and button quails, females lay the eggs, but the males brood on the eggs. So in those situations, your males are actually investing more in reproduction than the females are. And you get an inversion of behaviour where the female birds behave in what we would call a male fashion. They pursue the males, okay? So what this is telling us is that male behaviour, broadly speaking, is not a mere fact of that we're the custodians of sperm as compared to women be the custodians of ova. It's a consequence of the game theory results of different investments in reproduction. And, you know, I mean, some of these females are known to do behaviour that, I guess, if we were to put a human layer on it, we'd say quite obnoxious or vicious or whatever. They will actually go and destroy the eggs that the males have been brooding on, and then come along, and I guess the effective message is, gee, it's really sad your eggs have been destroyed and now you've got nothing to brood on, but hey, I'm here, aren't I? So, you know, that's what those birds are doing. So the next thing to concern ourselves with is sexual dimorphism. That's along the lines of sexual selection. Now, if you go to the zoo and look at the gorillas, you'll find that the male gorilla has a harem of, I don't know, four or five female gorillas, and is also about four or five times bigger than the female gorillas, if anyone remembers seeing that, if you've been to the zoo recently enough. Now, the reason for that is that basically male and females are generated at 50% ratio, and because one male is mating with about four or five females, that means that there's about four or five males that are losing out on that, so there's going to be a lot of conflict between the males to access the females. And that means those males are going to grow larger than you would otherwise need because they're basically bashing, beating up on each other. And that's sexual dimorphism. Now, if you look throughout the whole animal kingdom, it's very straightforward that you have basically the more the size between the males and females, the more it's the same, the more monogamous that species is. You get some bird species of birds which are basically monogamous, and the males and females have equal size. And obviously the gorillas are at one end of the spectrum, and looking at human beings, you could say that we are mostly monogamous on that scale. Now, what I've done is, I suppose, there is, I guess, a male way of looking at it, oh, you know, these male gorillas are mating with multiple female gorillas. But you can actually try to turn it around, because it's mostly a male-based analysis, I guess. But you can turn it around and say, well, is there a benefit for the female gorillas? What they are doing is they're denying themselves the opportunity to mate with multiple male gorillas. But what they have is the fact that if there's a predator, they have a large male gorilla to defend themselves from the predator, and if that predator mortally wounds the male gorilla, not a problem, they can find another group of gorillas to hang out with, assuming that the female gorillas there will accept them. But, you know, there's basically options for you and benefits. Then if we look at wasps, you get some interesting things happening for wasps that used to do sexual reproduction but now reproduce, in a sense, asexually. There's a particular sort of wasp that will basically, there's only females that fly around. It will basically put some eggs into a sort of a host pupa, and you'll have like a bunch of female wasps and perhaps one or more male wasps, and while in the pupa, the male wasps fertilise the female wasps. They then fly off, the males stay in the pupa and die, and then those female wasps will get to another pupa, and sort of basically the same thing will happen. So notice that that's a bizarre, it used to be sexual reproduction, and now it's basically just the females wandering around. And you might wonder, well, what's the number of females to males you want there? Now, you might say, oh, well, you know, one male wasp, 10 female wasps. And then you think, well, hang on, if that one male wasp dies for whatever reason, it's a single point of failure, and you've wasted your investment in 10 female wasps. And what if, you know, another wasp sort of like puts eggs in the same time as you do? So you probably want more than one male wasp there to basically get, have a bit of redundancy. And they actually did some numerical calculations and found that there was a very bizarre fraction of 3 male wasps for every 14 female wasps. Very bizarre thing. 3/14, you wouldn't reckon. But they did the calculation, and then they went out and looked at these wasps in the wild and found out, lo and behold, they were reproducing with this ratio of 3 male wasps to 14 female wasps. And that's one of the instances, I guess it doesn't happen often, where you can say that evolution is actually a science of prediction. It made a theoretical prediction, which people then went out and sussed out what was going on in the world, and lo and behold, it did actually happen. Some more interesting things is that fish can change sex. Now, there's a group of blue gropers around Maroubra, one male blue groper, a whole lot of female blue gropers. The male blue groper died for some reason, and then the largest female blue groper became a male blue groper, and things continued as before. If you actually read about blue gropers, they're supposed to start off female and turn male as they get older, but it does seem like in some instances they have a bit of a choice there as of what they do and when they change. So there's some very interesting things going on. A few more interesting things is that you might have heard of the species of chimpanzee called the bonobos, who are a lot less violent than the regular chimpanzees. And people say, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we were more like the bonobos? Now, genetically, we're actually closer to chimpanzees than we are to gorillas, but behaviourally, we're actually closer to gorillas because the chimpanzees, the male chimpanzees, don't actually look after their young. The male gorillas do actually take an interest in their young, so behaviourally we're closer to gorillas, while genetically we may be closer to chimpanzees. So to say, oh, if only we were like the bonobos, is a bit of a strange thing to say when you actually look at the details of it.
This is Big Ideas on RN and a talk by John August. Now he turns to a particularly difficult issue, rape. Evolutionary psychology and social sciences are on opposite ends when it comes to this. For social sciences, behaviour is strongly influenced by socialisation, and rape is more a crime of violence than sex. EP focuses on human nature being genetically determined, with rape having more in common with sex than the social sciences would agree to. Back to John August.
Now what I'll be talking about is EP and its analysis of rape. Now, obviously, this is, a controversial topic. I can obviously try to understand the trauma that rape survivors would endure. It's not something I would ever be able to properly understand. And, you know, yes, it is a sort of a nasty thing that is going on in society, but I still think that there are some useful things that EP can actually bring to bear on that. And on the one hand, it's controversial and difficult, but I still think this is worth engaging with. So that's what I will be talking about. And the other thing that's important to keep in mind is that I do think there is a difference between an explanation and an endorsement. So we can say that something exists. That's different to saying that this is a good thing. In the same way as we can try to understand a disease, we can try to understand hurricanes, but we would never say that hurricanes or disease are a good thing. So in this analysis, I guess there's two opposite poles that have, in fact, developed, which you might say is the social science story and the evolutionary psychology story. Now, what I would say is that there are some mild claims that come from the social sciences, which I do actually endorse. There are some important social facets to the prevalence of rape in our society that are best analysed from a social framework rather than an evolutionary psychology framework. Okay, that's fair enough. But at the same time, there are some extreme claims that the social sciences have actually made at times that do not stand up, and they do have problems. And I suppose the social sciences can point out some valid problems with EP. EP can point out some valid problems with the social sciences. And I think that's fair enough. Now, if you go into this debate saying it's one or the other, and if we can show that the other side is flawed, then we automatically win, well, that's one way of looking at it. And that seems to be a bit of the implicit debate that's happening. But I would never go into the picture assuming that it's one or the other and assuming that if you can undermine the other, that automatically means that your own side wins. I'm not so sure about that. So some of the issue coming from social sciences, I will develop this in a little bit more detail, but it seems that the people in the social sciences don't want rape to just be a facet of the English language. Obviously, we describe rape and consensual sex using different words because it is different. It's built into our English language. But the social science people seem to want to have a distinction between behaviour involved in consensual sex and a non-consensual sex, and basically have differences that are more than just a facet of the language. It's a much more deeper and stronger distinction. And that seems to be what they're trying to develop. I would also say Roseanne has done some research on this. I know that you've done a lot of data collection, a lot of analysis that was quite detailed and rigorous and far sweeping. And I know you came up with several conclusions out of that. Now, one conclusion, or one, you might say, statistical signal that came out of that on my reading of the research was that in terms of conviction rates, it did seem that the strongest proportion came out of people of low socioeconomic status raping other people of low socioeconomic status. Certainly other combinations did exist, but in terms of conviction rate, that was statistically the strongest thing. And to actually say, look, here is this thing happening, it's a facet of our society, it's a consequence of how our society is configured, basically a social perspective is the best way of understanding that. But equally, if you go back into history, there were some initial ambit claims that the social sciences made that were very extreme and showed clear overreach. And at the time, that was the claim historically was made, there is no rape in nature. We have since figured out that, no, there is something called forced copulation. It does happen in nature. So that was a clear case of overreach at the time. Now, the thing about the social sciences is it's all very amorphous and difficult to pin down. But I myself would personally be concerned about any past researchers who overreached in the past and now claim credibility. If in the past they never overreached and basically have had a consistent story from now back to the time when perhaps other people were claiming that there was no rape in nature, then they have a credible case. But, you know, I worry when people overreached in the past and still claim credibility unless they have basically eaten humble pie in the meantime, and that's a credible claim. So I've said, so basically there is a rape in nature. We know that that happens in the case of orangutans, and I think there's scorpion flies. Now, putting that to one side, there is rather severe violence where chimpanzees, on taking over a band, will actually kill the children or the young chimpanzees that have been fathered by different chimpanzees. And also with lions, there's a story that if a lion takes over a pride of lionesses, they will then kill all the male cubs. At least they will, it seems like they will leave the female cubs. Now, that's a certain amount of behaviour. Now, that's not forced copulation, but it's basically knocking out the old children so that the females are more receptive. And, of course, there are cases where we might say, look, this is forced copulation that has actually taken place. So there are some nasty things going on in the animal kingdom. Now, what I might try doing is try to articulate a few different positions in this story. Now, there's, I suppose, a caricature of the social science position that some EP researchers have put forward, and that's to say that the social scientists just say everything is socially determined, we're a tabula rasa, and, you know, it's basically just absorb all our social stimulation, you don't need to look any further. Now, I think that's an unfair caricature. I'm sure that there's some unfair caricatures that the social sciences are painting of evolutionary psychology. But let me articulate what I think might be a reasonable encapsulation of a vaguely defendable social science position. Rape is a crime of violence, not sex, in the sense that the primary cause is the denial of the sovereignty and integrity of the victim as a person, and a decision that is unrelated to sexual attraction. In looking at this decision, it is important to focus on the individual criminal and the social environment and what has been learnt. There are important aspects to rape which are a reflection of society and are problematic to capture in either social policy or law. Certainly, to consider sexual attraction in an evolutionary context is, at best, ignores and devalues these social realities, and at worst, positively undermines their recognition. Okay, so there's a position from the social sciences, such as I've been able to summarise it. Now, let's look at a viewpoint from evolutionary psychology, such as I've been able to articulate it. That will be, at some time in the past, some of our male ancestors pursued rape as a reproductive strategy for at least some of their lives, which resulted in improved reproductive success. This meant that the capability for rape was hardwired, and we can detect this fact by measuring behaviours in appropriate ways. Presumably, it would be reflected in some element of brain configuration, either in terms of its structure or the way neurons fire, but this is not measurable at current levels of technological development. Now, another thing I'll observe about these ideas is if you do actually say that rape is entirely socially determined, it begs the question of how did the first person to rape actually figure out how to do it, right? So it can't have been absolutely totally determined by social issues. Now, the other thing that comes from the social sciences is where they try to make distinctions between rape and other behaviour and try to partition it off. Now, I'll show you what I mean there. There's a claim that rape is not about sex because some rapists have regular partners. However, some people with regular partners also see prostitutes, and we don't say that that's unrelated to sexual desire. There's a claim that rapes are not sexually motivated because rapes are premeditated. But note that seduction and meetings of part of an affair are premeditated, but still considered sexually motivated. There's a claim that definitions are legal definitions subject to the vagaries of the legal system and do not map to useful delineations. That's certainly possible. We need to look at it in detail. How do the mappings have problems? Do the distortions within the legal system operate to distort conclusions we draw from the resultant data? In other words, that identifies potentially a valid problem, but it doesn't automatically undermine the EP point of view. The other thing I can say, you can see that what we've got here is, I guess, a semantic minefield. You know, we basically have some definitional issues that bring to bear, and in some sense, I don't think they're merely definitional issues. I don't think they're merely window dressing. At some level, these are significant things, and it is a struggle to understand that significance, because what we're worried about is what is sexual behaviour, what is non-sexual behaviour, what's consensual behaviour, what's non-consensual behaviour, and what is justified violence and what is unjustified violence. Because most ethical theories would actually say we can use violence in self-defence. So, but, you know, we obviously talk about violence in this way. We analyse it. But is there actually a neurological correlate in our brain that actually makes that distinction between justified and unjustified violence, or is it just something that operates at a higher level of abstract analysis? Then we have the nature of sexual behaviour. Now, one of the things that is also a bit of a complication here, I guess I have to speak a bit crudely, but not all rape involves sexual organs. You do actually have objects involved in it. And, of course, the question there is this sexual behaviour or is it just some representation of a power relationship of someone trying to bully or pick on someone else? But the issue becomes, does sexual behaviour necessarily involve the sexual organs? Now, basically, this is a broader definition of sexual behaviour, but I think it is meaningful. Let's think about kissing, okay? Kiss someone on the cheek. That is probably a gesture of friendship. Kiss them on the lips, that may be friendly or it may be, I guess, sexual. Now, I guess if it's a long kiss with a certain amount of expression, you'd probably say it's at the sexual end of the spectrum. Then, if we have something that is a tongue kiss, I think we could legitimately call that sexual behaviour, even though the genital organs are not involved. So you can see there is a definite semantic minefield in this whole issue, and I don't think anybody has really plumbed the depths of it. And basically people are working from, you know, half-considered definitions and then trying to build stuff on them. I suppose the old classic term is reification, I think, is one of the things you can have there. But then, you know, let's say this idea of rape being a crime of violence and not sex, well, maybe there's a bit of that going on, something metaphorically like the kids harassing the dogs or bullies picking on other people and basically taking advantage of any psychological weaknesses or weakness of appearance that they might have. So in a sense, there's just someone that someone wants to pick on, and the fact that there might be a sexual difference is sort of incidental to that. So maybe this idea of rape being a crime of violence or not sex does actually mean something. But then also I think both sides have a certain blind spot in that, be it social sciences or evolutionary psychology, they invariably seem to be talking about rape of women by men. You also have the other categories of rape of men by men, of men by women, and of women by women. And both these stories, they at best, they've got a very weak explanation of these other permutations. I mean, the social scientists might say, this is a patriarchal society, and when the men don't have women to pick on, well, they just pick on each other. But somehow that feels unsatisfying to me. Or that basically evolutionary psychology might say, well, men always want sex and it just gets converted and, you know, that's where it's coming from. But then again, evolutionary psychology would say that reproduction surely is at the core of everything we are talking about. So it does get confusing. So anyway, so there is a semantic minefield here that has not been properly mapped out. But I can also talk about risk analysis and the fact that we commit crimes. In committing crimes, we are violating social norms. We are violating social norms because we think we can get away with it, be that more regular crimes or the crime of rape. Maybe there's some useful perspectives there. So I have actually developed a different approach to things, which is what I call the emergent risk analysis hypothesis, which is saying that when we commit crimes, we assess risks. And let's sort of draw that a bit more broadly. Okay. In response to sexual desire, men can independently develop rape as a reproductive strategy without learning, based on a willingness to use violence and deny personal sovereignty, enlisting the support of risk analysis approaches, which are either hardwired or abstract analytic processes, which were not developed explicitly for the purpose of facilitating rape. While able to develop such strategies without learning, learning and social influence increases the chance of such developments. So we're saying, look, here is something called crime, criminal behaviour, violating social norms. Now, one of the things that does actually get talked about is that during war there's a lot more rape, and that's very true. And that's something that some of the social scientists have tried to take advantage of. The only thing is that during war there's a lot more criminal behaviour everywhere of every different sort. So to try to quarantine off rape and treat it separately in this context seems like a rather strange thing to do. Now, I suppose I could say a bit more about ethics and so on, but if I ever talk about this again, well, maybe that will truly be part two of this, given that I've actually finished part one. So there's more things that I could say, but I'll leave it at that for the moment. Thank you.
John August, the Vice President of the Humanist Society of New South Wales. And now a quick look to next week. On Tuesday, we'll continue our leadership dialogue series, this time about citizen juries and deliberative democracy. What is it?
It's simply a new form of sharing power where lay people, non-aligned lay people, understand the issues, the data, different viewpoints. They come to a coherent voice forward, and that's influential.
There's ways to do participation well, there's ways to do it badly. The starting point for us is really, let's not be do government by opinion poll. What's the opposite of that? I don't care what you think in the next 5 seconds. I care more what you think having spent 40 or 50 hours on it and discussed it with other people.
So the participation, the deliberation, they're key words. It tells us something about the way this is done.
Absolutely. Deliberation is what it means. Don't rush to judgment. Too often, one of the most common things I hear from local government is they've gone out and asked the community their view. And what do they hear? Well, I want more services and lower rates. That's completely useless. If you actually pose people a problem and say, what's the services you want in your area? This is not a wish list. This is a trade-off exercise. You can have less rates by all means. Tell us what you can live without. And it's getting to a trade-off, whereas democracy has become inherently a wish list.
For me, the basic problem is that people simply do not trust governments anymore. It doesn't matter where we look, local government, state government, federal government, across the Western world, less than 50%, sometimes 25% of the people say they have any trust in government at all. These are the people we have elected, apparently, to make decisions on our behalf. What do we do differently? We learn from our history. We go back to what they were doing at the origins of democracy, Athenian democracy. We use random sample. We stop pretending that people are dumb. They're inherently incredibly smart.
A panel of experts explains citizen juries, a revolution in sharing political power. That's coming up on Big Ideas next Tuesday. I'm Paul Barclay. That's it for tonight. Bye for now.
It's been 13 years since you made those controversial remarks about President Bush. I think you said he was the most dangerous and incompetent president in living memory. Any regrets?
No, I look back on that and think I was more than a critic, I was a prophet.
An unrepentant Mark Latham in conversation with Tom Switzer, plus young US Republicans and gay marriage. That's Between the Lines, online at the RN homepage.